Thanks, guys, so far. So I have a couple of quick questions that I've been dying to ask you all. I'm going to start in the original order of the panel. So first for you, Michael, could you kind of deep dive a bit more into some good examples of the kind of awesome things that we see when these services are available?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, talk about the service delivery process. How can you make it better?
So one thing I wanted to mention, I just wanted to remember to mention, was that actually none of the data we, none of the data that we use is actually open. None of the data my company uses, none of it is clearly licensed, or if it's clearly licensed, it doesn't necessarily allow for reuse. So it's meant for public consumption, and for the CRA, you can ask them for reuse, and we did that. But all the other ones, it's just kind of like government information. In terms of the value, nonprofits cast about for like trying to find funding, and it's this mysterious, mysterious process. And everybody does it, like these top organizations. You know, it's about who'd you talk to yesterday, who's now running a foundation, and what is possibly the new funding interest, and it's this secretive world just because there's no clear information. It's very similar to the work that Michael's doing, where it's taking something and making it unnecessarily confusing because of its opacity. Opacity? Mm-hmm. So just taking the information and organizing it, it's trivial in some ways. It's interesting the work we do because we are pulling it from 85,000 different organizations, 10,000 foundations, all these different federal and provincial, 900 federal and provincial government programs. But it's a trivial, trivial concept. And just by doing that, we're helping those 85,000 charities kind of, and helping sector leaders that are arguing. You know, an example is, people in the nonprofit sector have been moved from operational funds, so you get money to exist and fulfill your mission, to project-based fund, where you don't get money to exist, you get money to do a certain thing. And it's kind of a way of controlling the outputs a little bit more, and definitely people in the nonprofit sector don't like it. But how that information is shared and how that the response to that is based on anecdotal data, as opposed to saying, like, here's a funder that's doing this, we see their switch over 2 years, and we can articulate a response to it as opposed to being like, we're upset that I've heard stories that you've, messed with your funding model.
So you think that the increase in transparency has the potential to make some organizations a little uncomfortable?
Well, funders, yeah, especially if you look at private family foundations, public foundations, they're not used to scrutiny. Mm-hmm. And they're not used to scrutiny because people can't scrutinize them, right? So if you actually, and it's great, what we do as a service is we take the question, or we approach the question of who you should ask for funding, as opposed to saying, this is what the funder says they do, so you can ask them based on their stated intentions. So forget about their stated intentions. Look at who they actually give money to over the last 10 years and what amounts, and, go with that, because they say they're funding health, but they're actually just funding their university alma mater or whatever it is. So making that information available, and what's more interesting about what we've managed to do, rather than just correlating the data, is to find a business model for it that encourages us to do that work. We have people in government that are buying our service to find out this information from their own data sets, and we're working with academics and sector leaders to provide them this information that they've never had access to before. So going beyond providing a service, a commercial service, providing this information to policymakers and researchers.
Awesome. One of my favorite stories in this domain is a former Sauvé scholar named David Eves.
Yeah.
Pictures
upstairs.
Yeah, there are some really cute baby face pictures of David Eves upstairs if anyone's interested. He has a really excellent write-up on his blog called Open Data and the Public Purse, which tells the story of a research group that figured out, sort of by accident, just by sorting a couple of Excel columns, that there was some significant charitable tax fraud happening in Canada to the tune of about $3.4 billion, and it was getting worse every year. It was just hiding in plain sight. So you know, they weren't even looking. It makes me wonder what we could find if there was actually a determined effort and workforce sort of behind looking for people who are not playing by the rules. So James, you've been doing this open data stuff for a long time, and I mean, things are certainly getting better. There's better infrastructure. People know what you're talking about when you bring it up. If you could choose like two sort of awesome developments in the open data sphere, whether it's social or technical, that would really help advance the cause of open data, what would it be?
Well, I mean, when I think of where I'd like to see open data go, I often think of getting more people to actually use open data, and like in terms of who we're missing in the conversation right now. And like I know David Eves has written quite a bit about this as well, so maybe just to pick one group, I think there needs to be a lot more businesses using open data and building businesses around it, because we don't want open data to become a sort of checkbox that governments fill, like, oh yes, we got that transparency check down.
Right.
We want the continued investment in open data, and so and not having that economic incentive, I think, will be popular with every government. So two things that can make open data a bit more attractive to businesses is, I'd say one would be open standards, and other having to do with licenses. So in terms of standards, let's say that I develop an app in Montreal at some hackathon that lets you more easily find extracurricular activities for your kids and, you know, for yourself, offered by the City of Montreal. And this app lets you schedule these things in much more easily. Or it's currently, I think they've published like a huge book and like an enormous PDF, and you just need to go through it all and like, no, that activity doesn't fit my schedule. It'd be much easier if you could just have an app to do that, right? So let's say the City of Montreal publishes it in a like a beautiful format, since the City of Montreal has become so nice with us about publishing things we ask for. And so it's working in Montreal, but I don't really have that many users here because it's just one city. So I'm like, okay, well, if I could get 12 more cities, maybe it will work. But then you look at what the other cities are doing, and it's all like all different things. So some people don't even publish it online. Some people have like an online database, but it's all different formats. And for me to actually pull it in, it would cost so much that it's not really worth spreading to those other cities. And so I just need to abandon this, like this product that would have been viable, like say if all governments had adopted a standard. Then. So in general, the main point of standards is that it lowers the cost for these sorts of more marginal businesses to actually become sustainable. And in terms of licensing, I had I put in a slide for licensing in case it came up. for the government of Ontario. There's several open data portals that have this sort of term in their license. What it basically says is, another way of building a business around open data is I take some government data and I tie it in with some other data that maybe I have as, say, like a private company, and then I sell this value-added data sets to people. I can't think of a good example right now, but there are companies that do this sort of thing. Let's say that there's actually some other company that has rights over that data that Ontario is distributing. Well, now, like say they sold it to Ontario and Ontario merged it with the data set that they're publishing and they forgot about it. So now that company can sue me because I'm distributing their data, but this clause means that I cannot sue the Ontario government for putting me in this awful mess. And that sort of situation really discourages a lot of companies from using open data because there just aren't those guarantees. Of course, getting rid of this guarantee would be very difficult for government because they don't really have a good idea of all the rights attached to data sets. Mm-hmm. So there'd have to be more infrastructure on their end, but I just wanted to raise that.
So, I mean, a lot of this really boils down primarily to fear. Like, people want to be protected against this data coming out and sort of stabbing them in the back later on down the line. And hopefully education and people seeing that there are, you know, mostly good things that come of having transparency. And actually, Michael, you could probably speak to, you know, how do you get into people's heads and convince them that, you know, this is the right way to go forward and that it's not just about respect and ethics, but it could also have, you know, profound value as well.
Right. So, I mean, my experience has been working with, governments and large institutions, and you know, by their very nature, they tend to be conservative. They don't want to take risks. So, you know, in the case of the IATI initiative, what seems to have been working quite well is that there are examples. And so, you know, when you then try to convince an organization like a CETA or another development organization or foundation about the merits of sharing, when they can already see an example that there's a community that exists already that are sharing, mm-hmm. it puts an emphasis on them to then be part of that community. And then conversely, as we saw here in Canada with Engineers Without Borders, by not sharing actually puts them somewhat in the spotlight too. Right. So Engineers Without Borders did that campaign where they had the big black box all over the place. Undoubtedly, that had some impact on their thinking towards sharing in the IATI format. I think the other thing that's interesting too with large institutions is, although open data seems like it's purely about sharing information in the public domain or in the public space, my experience has been that these institutions actually use these kinds of initiatives as a catalyst to actually change their internal sharing, just as much as trying to share with the public. Large institutions, I'm working with UN OCHA in New York right now. They're you know, a huge organization. There may be 4,000 or 5,000 people working there. They don't even know where all their information is. So, you know, thinking about using this idea of sharing open data, they're using it like a catalyst to say, okay, let's get on this bandwagon. But really, there's communications officers in that organization that just want to find the information they need to report accurately for their own purposes. And I think, lastly, building on that, many organizations are kind of in a state of change where they're trying to think about their relevance for the future. And one way to do that is to sort of transition to be a bit of a knowledge organization. And by having accurate, timely information, it makes them a leader. So, you know, these are the kinds of things I've seen.
So it's not what you got, it's what you do with it. It makes sense. I mean, it's the stuff that guys like Ted and James and a lot of you are building often end up being better tools to access an organization's data than what they previously had themselves. Certainly better than anything from Microsoft or Oracle. I mean, honestly, you guys think from the perspective of a user first and foremost, and I think that gives you an empathy that a large company simply can't have. So I want to open it up. I'm sure that all of you have some thoughts and some ideas. I know you do first. Should I bring the microphone, or you're going to? Naomi is our runner. Do you want to stand up, and Naomi can come over to you? We do need everybody to sort of speak into the microphone for posterity.
So a question for James. You mentioned the advantage of a format, I guess, or a standard for data. I was just wondering, do you know if anyone has presented that case to the Canadian Federation of Municipalities, and to try and get across the importance of that concept?
Well, I know that Yuri Conga has been doing a lot of work. He presents. Who's Yuri?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know exactly what he does right now, but he does.
He's a private consultant.
Right. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not new, I guess. So, he's worked within municipalities I forget the name group. MISA, yeah, Municipal Information System Administrators Ontario, sort of thing. So he's been presenting a lot to governments about like what the interest in open data is and like why they should do it. And I think he's helped push a lot of cities in Ontario to start adopting open data. I mean, especially since I've started presenting, I've seen more of them do it, so at least the correlation there. And he often talks to them also about data standards. In terms of like whether there are people pushing specific standards, I mean, outside data standards, cities generally are interested in adopting standards, but like especially like financial standards, for instance. So I think they get it. It's just that often the data sets that we want standardized aren't necessarily things that they need operationally. And so it's a bit harder to make the case that they need to spend these additional resources massaging their data into the format that you want everyone else to adopt. But in our work, we also talk to municipalities. I mean, the reason the City of Ottawa publishes their elected representatives in a format at all is because we propose it to them. And they're talking within a network, a small network of open data cities, which I think is called the G4, and now it became bigger, which includes Vancouver, Toronto, and Ottawa. They're in Ottawa, so I don't know.
Edmonton.
Oh, and Montreal's added now. To try to convince them to do it as well. But those are the initiatives I know of for data standards in cities.
Excellent.
Hello? Questions for Michael from Aja. Is there any uptake from journalistic institutions, journalists using your tool to scrape the data for stories, where money from foundations are going, big donors, et cetera?
No, it's interesting. I think people have looked through the CRA, people have looked through the CRA data set, the Canada Revenue Agency data set on charities. But there's probably still more work to be done with that. I think unfortunately the CRA does this weird thing where you're required as a funder to report to them every gift you give out as a foundation. You're required to give, as a foundation, you've put this money aside. It's not taxed, right? So that's why you have to report to the CRA, say, this is what we're doing with it. And you're only allowed to distribute it to organizations that have charitable status. So it stays in that kind of non-taxed area. You can't give it to a nonprofit that doesn't have charitable status. So you have to report all the grants you give out, but the CRA only types in the first 10. So out of the data they give out, it doesn't have a full list of all the grants you're giving, so you can't really do a story on how the 10,000 foundations or 5,000 private foundations are distributing money. But the stories that people would be interested in doing and people in the sector would be interested in seeing is when you do allow people to take money out of the taxable pool that pays for government, where does that money go? And there's ideas that maybe it goes mostly to, you know, universities, secondary schools, art galleries, you know, the opera house kind of high culture thing, as opposed to people giving money to sex workers and homeless people kind of thing. So there would be stories there, but it's encumbered because not all the data made available. The other data sets that we do have are the provincial spending data that I don't think anyone's ever looked at. So there's probably stuff there that would be interesting. I'm happy to talk to anybody who wants to use our data. You know, of course, that's why one of the reasons we're here.
So Naomi, it's 10 o'clock right now. Do we have time for another question from the back room, maybe? Okay.
Councillor Dita Burku from Côte Saint-Luc.
Thank you very much. Your stories are really interesting. I'd like to know from all of you, have you ever tried to get access to information, you know, the sort of traditional route, and pursuant to the last, answer that you gave, Michael, like if you asked the CRA for access to information, would you get that information? And by pushing that method, can you push for more open data?
So I'll answer quickly. I'm deeply, deeply ashamed that I've never written a Freedom of Information request yet, and you called me out on it. That's embarrassing. But one day soon. The CRA doesn't have that information in a digital form. Well, it has digital because it's a scanned image. So they're pretty helpful about giving us access, giving us what we want, but they don't actually have the budget to type in all the grants that are being sent to them manually. So that's my answer. But yes, I think you're right that it would encourage that type of behavior, and it should be done, absolutely.
So the cases where I've looked for data hardest is actually relevant to the representative project that I presented earlier, where some cities just don't want to give us their ward boundaries for hard-to-understand reasons. So the one city that we had to pursue this the furthest was the town of Whippy, where we always start by sending an email saying, like, can you send us the ward boundaries? And usually they say yes, and they send us an attachment right away. Sometimes they send us a license agreement first. But in this case, they said no, we just don't share that unless you have a contact with the city like your Microsoft or IBM or something. And so we filed an access information request, which was refused because they said it was already publicly available, because there was a PDF on their website that had these word boundaries. But that's not really what we need. We need like the actual geospatial coordinates. And so we went through the whole appeal process, which in Ontario is actually pretty good. They do mediation, and the people who work for the IPC, Information Privacy Commissioner in Ontario, are very good people. So they were able to convince the city that this is the kind of thing that they need to be sending to us, and so we eventually got it. And in terms of the second part of the question about making this an opportunity for increased access, I don't know if it's happened with WIPI, but we kind of went part of the way with the City of Vaughan, where we sent the access information request, and that was immediately successful. There wasn't any appeal. And afterwards, I emailed the people that I had originally been in contact with saying, like, okay, well, we got the data after all, even though you didn't send it to us at first. And they're like, yeah, so I think we're going to look at our policies and try to fix that so it's more easily available in the future.
I mean, in my case, I haven't done any Freedom of Information requests. I know that, you know, in the case of IATI, a lot of the information is sent to the OECD DAC, so those are places where those requests can be made. But before there was an IATI, there was always a threshold. So under a certain amount of dollars, projects just weren't registered at all. And also the depth and breadth of the information that was shared was minimal.
Whitby, remember that when you allocate your tourist dollars. Naomi?
Thank you. I think we can give panel one a big round of applause.